This is Bird's Eye View, your sailing podcast. Live, Sail, Die have put together what we hope is going to be the most informative and entertaining sailing podcast you have ever heard. I'm Darcy Watergrave. I'm hosting and trying to keep these two roustabouts calmed down. Joey Allen, Barbara Kendall, two of the biggest names in New Zealand sailing. We'll be broadcasting from the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron's Crow's Nest, one of the iconic rooms in New Zealand sailing. Lock yourself in. This is going to be fun.
Bird's Eye View is sponsored by Andu, New Zealand's home of feel-good living. With free next-day delivery and price match guarantee, feel good about your appliances and furniture with Andu.
Welcome on into Live, Sail, Die's podcast. This is Bird's Eye View. My name is Darcy Watergrave, and here we go again. We have got our regular corroborators on the show, the people that basically aid and abet what is a sailing crime here.
Corroborated or collaborated?
Well, we're corroborating because we're doing it together, aren't we?
Robbing somebody.
Yeah, well, that's why I said...
robbing them of their own.
Yeah, that's why I said aided and abetted, because it's vaguely criminal. It's not, okay. Really. And this is Barbara Kendall. Not only is she a medalist at the Olympic Games, she's also a wee bit on the... I'm going to tell the host how to talk. I mean, is it called a pedant?
It's our job to keep you...
Yeah, okay, no, it's a very good point. Joey Allen, you haven't said anything yet, and your hands aren't folded across your chest, so you must be feeling in a good mood. Stop wasting everyone's time and get onto the target, mate. We'd like to thank Andu very much, as per, for being involved in this podcast. And we'd like to thank our guest, Jan Shearer, for taking the time to join us here at Bird's Eye View. G'day, Jan Shearer. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Just listening at the moment. That's all good.
Well, we'll get you talking soon. In fact, we'll start things off. Barb, you can run with this because, of course, you're mates.
Yeah, well, Jan and I go back a really long way. In fact, the first World Championships that I went to was in Lards in Scotland, and Jan was there as well. So she was sort of like, you'd done one before that, hadn't you? You'd done a World Championships before 19...
Maybe, but I can remember Lags and it being really windy and really cold.
Yes, yes. And they fed us like fried food every morning. And when they spoke, I couldn't understand a word that they were saying. And it was all very overwhelming for a girl fresh off the boat. But Jan was amazing. Jan and Fiona.
Fiona, yes, that's right.
Yeah. So do you want to go right back to the beginning of how you got it?
Exactly what I was going to say. That's normally what you roll to. Come on, I know you got it eventually. Come on, Kendall.
Forming the connection first. So back to the beginning. Roll back. How did you get into sailing?
How did I get into sailing? Well, my father sailed, and then I did a tiny little bit of sailing through my teenage years in Dunedin. Shifted to Auckland with my job, and then started sailing laser. And what happened was, eventually the opportunity came up to go to to trial for the Olympic Games, because in 1988 it was the first time they had women in the games, and it was the 470 class.
Isn't that extraordinary that it took so long to have Wahine at the Olympics in sailing?
I mean, that's 1988.
Yes.
And the Olympics started in 1896, modern Olympics. So you think, yeah. Anyway, carry on, Glenn.
That's fine. No.
I kept interrupting. We're a bit like this. So
that's fine. I have to just maintain my train of thought. So yes, 88 was sort of the goal. And so then we campaigned towards that. So I switched from the laser to the 470 and sailed with Fiona Galloway. And we won the trials and went to Seoul.
Right. And you went to Seoul. And how was Seoul?
So,
remember back then, how did you get there, and what was the journey?
I think the key thing was that it was very amateurish, and you know, it's progressed hugely over the years. But right back then, of course, you know, you're just doing the fundraising, like sausage sizzle level of fundraising, and then Seoul was a great experience. And I think, you know, obviously, if you dial back, we were really amateurs. Got there. We came ninth, I think it was, in the end. But the conditions were pretty horrendous. You know, they weren't exceptionally well set up, dirty water, you know, really windy and rough, all those sorts of things. You know, it's come a long way since then. But that was the first time women had their own class in the Olympic Games.
And did you train with the men, and did you have a coach, and who funded the campaign? All those sorts of things back in 88.
We self-funded, and technically, we didn't really have a coach. They had staff and management that went to the Olympic Games, but we looked after ourselves pretty much.
But you said very amateur. How did that manifest itself? I knew you had no funding, so that was big. What else stood out to you as things have developed with that first Olympic Games?
I think that, you know, it's just a whole different environment and a whole different landscape now where, you know, I mean, jumping forward like, you know, 35 years, it's like you can't really compete unless you have government funding. And so then this is where the issue comes, because obviously bang for buck, you can't fund a whole squad. So then it gets narrowed down. And then, you know, you've only got one or two sailors that genuinely have the opportunity to be successful. And that's kind of unfortunate, because if I dial back, you know, I feel like it is still an amateur sport. So you've currently got athletes trying to behave like professional athletes in an amateur game. And so this is where the necessity for funding kicks in. But back in the day, we could work and fundraise, sail in the evenings and at the weekends, do two or three trips to Europe, which you fundraised for, and you were competitive, whereas now you wouldn't be able to do that. So that's the difference, I think. And I feel like that, you know, is way more character building, and as a person, it's easier on you, because I think nowadays with all the higher stakes, let's say, that's where the wellness issues come in, and the fairness and the transparency, and that's where it becomes so complicated, because really tough decisions have to be made, and they're brutal on people. And so that, you know, that's the structure of the system we're within, with, you know, relatively small times in terms of professionalism, sports. So you're trying to compete in that arena.
And I think also, if we wind back the clock a little bit as well, 88 was the last Olympic Games where you had to be an amateur to compete. So professionalism didn't come in until 1992, because that's when we had the dream team. Remember in Barcelona, that it was a big thing. Oh my God, the dream team's coming in, you know, and how exciting that was, because they opened it up so you could actually compete and earn prize money. Not that there was any prize money in women's 470. Or it's not today.
Well, it's not a professional sport. There's not an avenue. I mean, for the men now in sailing, you know, obviously there's a well-trodden professional circuit. And you know, then of course there's the America's Cup and all the rest of it. But for women, it's still pretty hard yards, even now.
Yeah.
To make a living out of it.
And then after 88, then what made you decide to go to Barcelona?
Well, then I saw, you know, I could see that we were competitive, but just needed a bit more. And of course, you get exposed and you realise, oh, you know, this is reachable, but, you know, we need to be more professional and organised and structured, et cetera, et cetera. So in 92, I sailed with Leslie Egnott, and then we had Hamish Wilcox as our coach, but only right at the very end. And so that all, you know, just raised the level, let's say. And it was just an opportunity that worked and a combination that worked.
So why the coach at the vet, when you say the very end, was that at the end of the actual regatta itself?
No, the end of the campaign. Like we had Hamish only something like 3 weeks before the actual Olympic.
Hang on. When did you meet your husband? When did your husband know a little bit about 470s, didn't he?
Yeah, but he was sailing himself as well. Like, yeah, he wasn't coaching.
He'd be helping that.
Could. Yes. So
for those that don't know, because Jan is Jan Shearer and Murray Jones is Murray Jones, and Murray Jones is a well-known character in the world of sailing. When did you guys hook up?
A bit private now, isn't it?
No, 82.
Is there rum involved?
82. Did you meet sailing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I have to think. Yes.
We're removing the cobwebs from your from your memory.
Girls talk.
Joey, you'll be quiet.
You need to explain that Murray knew a little bit about 470s.
I'm not saying that. Yes. Probably more to the point was, and this is more the issue of today, is that, of course, we could go sailing in Takapuna and there would be 25 or even maybe sometimes 40 470 boats, men and women, sailing off Takapuna every weekend. And so you had a domestic fleet, world class. And, you know, the men were finishing three of them in the top 10 at the world champ type of level. And so, you know, if it was moderate and lighter winds, we were definitely competitive. So you had that regular racing. And this is what makes it so difficult now, because there's no domestic fleet.
Mm.
And in fact, you know, that could be an option for New Zealand to switch back to something like that, and maybe even have, you know, communal gear and some sort of much more holistic program, as opposed to just picking a couple of teams, boats, sailors, whatever, and just funding them, whereas rebuild the domestic fleet and train here. I mean, we have no excuses here for sailing. We've got role models, we've got history, we've got success, we've got access, we've got funding.
Great weather.
We've got everything going.
Amazing coaches.
Yep. All of
technology,
that.
Technology.
All of it. But the only disadvantage is that our geographic location isolates us from overseas. But on the other hand, you know, we have a good level. Like in other sports, the level in New Zealand, you know, isn't good enough. And so you're always trying to benchmark yourself. Whereas in sailing, we are.
Jan Chair is our guest. This is Live, Sail, Die, the Bird's Eye View podcast. So you go talking about fleets and the size of the fleets now. Why did it diminish? Was that purely funding? Was that lack of interest? Is there a want now to pick this up again? Or
I think that, you know, a few people end up getting supported and then they just jump ahead, because they go, every time you go overseas, invariably when you come back, you've taken a step up. And if you can build on that and keep going, then you just, you know, the gap becomes too big between, you know, those that are weekend warriors and those that are sailing overseas. And that's what happened. It just gapped. And then so people just fell away.
So primarily, the way to get it back up and running again is money.
Well, I think...
exposure internationally.
Part of that is, it's only partially money for New Zealand. But I think now even making a class, an Olympic class, is kind of like a death knell, because they don't, well, just what I'm saying is only a few get funded and they step right out, and so the rest of them can't compete, and so they'll go and sail something that they can compete as a weekend warrior or whatever. But I guess, the laser, and there are some classes where there's kind of like two divisions, and that's fine too. So, but just accessibility and.
Interesting. You thought being an Olympic class that would drive people in hordes toward it, because they've got a target, they've got a goal, they've got something they want to do.
Yeah, I think it's like what Jen is saying, is that the ones that go overseas make this big jump because they've been exposed to really intense competition for over a series of months, and then you come back and you race. That's what happened with me. I'd come back and I'd be so much better than my competitors that I was competing against, that the gap got harder and harder to close because you got so experienced. And so unless you bring that younger generation through with you and actually mentor them and coach them and bring them through, that there's big gaps that happen in a fleet. And also the expense, because it's getting more and more technical and more high tech. So the amount of money that's poured into, you know, the 49ers, the NACRAs, the FXs, which are the more expensive upper end of our fleets, it's really difficult to fund. So unless you have sort of government funding, sponsorships, or sugar daddies or mummies, you know, it's actually quite hard to do. So yeah, let's wind it back into Barcelona. What are your memories of Barcelona coming into those final races where you knew that you were in the middle run?
Well,
can you remember that?
Yeah. No, but Mike Clark.
Yeah, there we go.
That's my memory. Yes, I remember going into the last race. We had a table, you know, stick it onto our boat. You know, we finish there, they finish there. This, you know, then you're going to get second, third, fourth, whatever. So we did have that. But that very last race, what happened was the day before we had a measurement protest, and it was in the end thrown out, but that was quite stressful. And so we came down in the morning to find that measurement protest had been thrown out. The technical committee.
Not enough,
because they just do a spot check.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, it was something that hadn't been passed right through properly, so it was a null and void situation. Anyway, and it had no material impact on performance anyway. But it was like your mask came out of the gate like an inch more than it should have, when it was unrigged, when the boat was unrigged. Anyway, so going into that last race, I remember actually approaching the start line and everybody was bunched up the windward end, and Leslie and I were sort of like halfway down, and then Leslie's like, we're going for the pin, we're going for the pin. And so we just went for the pin, and us and the German boat were right down the other end, tacked onto port, and so we just were launched.
Awesome.
Did you cross?
We went all the way to the ley line, and then we picked a perfect ley line, two tacks.
Oh.
Wow, you send it. You
sent it.
Back the ley line, they call it.
Yeah. The right starboard ley line.
Yeah.
Yep. And that was it. Yep. And then what happened was the Germans, it didn't matter, but the Germans crossed the line first, and then they got a measurement protest because their water bottles were too heavy.
No.
So they got disqualified, so we won the race.
Wow. So you run the last race in Barcelona.
Water bottles.
Yeah, wait.
Yeah, because
that's crazy. Something like that is not thought about before.
Of course. Oh, you're wearing, the crew is wearing the water bottle.
The weight.
You know, this is gone now because the welfare of the athlete, you know, and their back and their whatever. Because, you know, the Finns used to wear, and later, and to send your crews.
When I competed on the World Cup, when I was racing on the professional circuit, because I was too small, I wore 6 kilos of lead on me, like a bulletproof vest. Because I had to be heavy enough, and that would put me up to sort of like 62 kilos, 63 kilos. And the girls I was competing with were like 75, 80. And when you fell in the water, you were lucky. It was a little bit dangerous because you were sinking and you had to grab your gear. And then when you got to the beach, you could hardly walk because you had this lead weight on you. So that was the extreme. But in sailing, there was a certain amount. Remember Russell Coutts had the problem in 84. Was being weighed after he came out, and he was a little bit over with his, because he'd had woolly jerseys on, because that would put on the weight. So, yeah.
You mentioned a couple of times since we've been talking about the mental health of athletes. Not something that you're recently hard on, how that actually operates?
It's such a key thing right now because, just currently working in sport, there's an emphasis on it. And it's always like, yes, results as well as, people thrive in the sport, and you know their welfare and their well-being is a consideration, and you have to look after that. But it's because, you know, I would maintain that it's because of the structure of the system. We can't change it, but you know the Olympics is, you know, held in such high esteem, and particularly in New Zealand and probably in most countries, that you know that's the pinnacle. It's 4 years, 4 year cycle. If you're going to do two campaigns and you know try and win a, it's usually people don't get a medal on their first campaign. It's usually their second. 8 years in a young person's life is a massive amount of time. It's a huge investment and venture capital with your time. And potentially, you're going to go into an Olympic program and campaign and come out maybe with no Olympic experience, no medal, no money, and very little in the way of transferable skills. And you're kind of like restarting your whole life all over again in your late 20s or, you know, early 30s. So that's where, in our day, I was working. I had a degree, I had a job, I had a house. And when I won my medal, I had a 22-month-old child. So it was like, you know, I just had a normal life.
And what did you do in that space to help yourself out? Were you aware of that? As you said, it's a relatively new concept, this whole look after the health of the athlete first and foremost before you're worrying about winning anything. Are you aware of that? Did you take any steps to help yourself?
You mean back in my day?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't even a thing because we didn't have that pressure of having to get into the funding and having to meet criteria of your national body to get chosen and all that side of things. You were just on your own, and so you were in charge of your own pathway and your own journey.
So in Barcelona, you didn't have Matthew there, no?
Yeah, 22 months old.
22 months in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
And who looked after, because I mean this is logistics, because Murray
was there too.
So who looked after the child?
Parents. Our parents.
Thank God for that.
In Barcelona or back in New Zealand?
In New Zealand.
Yeah, because Murray was competing in the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah.
So both, wow. Yeah. Think about that. Husband and wife competing in Olympic Games with a kid back at home. You might have been one of the first women to compete with a baby at the Olympic Games from New Zealand.
Maybe.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's a stat. I mean, think about that for a minute. And
win a medal.
And win a medal with a baby. That's got to be the first.
Well, it was really thought to actually taking child with, because now we're seeing that, aren't we? We're seeing athletes winning medals and their bubs are sitting in the grandstand.
I know, yeah.
So for those that didn't know, Jan won a silver medal. I mean, just in case if you're listening and you didn't know who Jan Shearer was, she won a silver medal in the 470 in Barcelona with a kid, and her husband was competing as well. I mean, just think about that. Yeah, I mean, you take it for granted, I know, but it's just like, it was really trailblazing.
Well, I think the other part of it was people say they're busy, and I'm like, oh, no, you don't know what busy means.
Yeah. Yes. And it's still today.
Still today.
Did you have much to do with Joe, the girls that followed you?
Joe Ellie.
Joe.
Oh, a little bit.
There was some trickle down.
Didn't you jump in the 470 with someone else?
Melinda.
Yeah, right.
No, not for Sydney. No, for the next one.
Okay, so what about for 96? What happened in 96?
Leslie and I went.
Okay, right.
Yeah. But Leslie was carrying that injury from the America's Cup.
Right.
Remember that.
Yes, that's right.
It's Atlanta, yeah.
Exactly. And the sailing was in Savannah.
Okay, and then you so you were still working, still campaigning, and then you decided to go for 2000 as well.
No, didn't do 2000 at all. I stepped away from it. And then in 2004... like literally, I'm going to say months before the trials, Melinda and I got together and won the trials, and then Yachting New Zealand decided not to send her.
Right. The old selection.
Was it just because?
Yeah, because she was too old with kids in tow.
Two kids.
You shouldn't be able to, I know, two kids in tow. You shouldn't be, you should be back in the kitchen sink. Yeah, so there we go. Who knows?
So after that, you don't, not say disillusioned with the Olympic program, but you thought there's no point anymore. What kind of a blow was that to you, if it was?
Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely signed out.
Yeah.
I haven't actually sailed since then.
Almost. Wow, there you go. And then, amazingly, Jan, tell us about your kids. Both of them got into sailing. How could they not with a mother and father? How did that go?
Well, I want to say that because of myself having done lots of different sports, that's what we did. Because, we're keen skiers, hikers, biking, tennis. I play golf now. Well, a whole lot of different stuff. I like doing lots of different things. I love the sailing. I love the competing. There's nothing else I would have rather done through those 30 years of sailing. But it wasn't all in the intense level. Let's say 15 years, that was quite intense. Anyway, so they did a range of different sports. And both of them sailed when we lived in Valencia with the America's Cup, which was, 5 years. And it was quite a different program then because you kind of drop your kids off and the monitors looked after them. It wasn't like here where the parents are very involved. You would drop your kids off and they'd take them away for the weekend and they'd be sailing in a competition down the road or whatever and have a great time. So it was quite a different setup and arrangement.
So you sent your kids into a camp and they would stay there for the whole weekend or the whole week and then you'd go and pick them up.
That's right.
Wow. That's what we need to do. How fun would that be?
Oh, they had a great time and they go off in the van with all the kids.
You haven't got parents trying to coach from the sideline either, have you? That's got to be huge. They can actually fully focus on what they're
eating, sleeping, playing, sailing.
Yep.
You're hooked after that.
Improve it by they could keep them for the week.
Yeah, well, I keep them for the month. How about the year?
Mother of the year over there. Barbara Kendall.
You go look after them.
And Joey Allen, myself, Darcy Waldegrave, courtesy of And Do Feel Good. This is Live, Sail, Die podcast, Bird's Eye View, and we're joined by Jan Shearer. Jan, there's something else I'd like to carry on with. You mentioned your love for all of these sports, and it does take you away from sailing, and this is a sailing podcast after all, but your involvement, engagement across a number of different sports has been extraordinary. Water polo, tennis, snow sports, canoe racing New Zealand. You've been everywhere. You've done everything. How does that operate? Transferable skills from what you picked up in sailing? Why the engagement?
Okay, so I worked as an engineer up until we went and lived in Valencia for 5 years, and then had a great time there, 5 years, no working. You know, the kids were young, teenagers. Came back, and it's like, oh, there's no one really here to play with because everybody's working. And so I'm like, oh, I may as well go back to work. And so then I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I thought, I'll try and marry up, because I'd done a master's in management, and then I'll marry that up with my sailing and sporting background and see if I can work in sport. And I didn't really even know, when I was looking at the job adverts, what that actually meant, what you would actually be doing, you know, like I was really removed from it as such. And then I loved watching tennis, and I'd got hooked on that when I was overseas in Europe, going to, you know, Roland Garros and all the rest of it. So I thought, oh, I'd like to work in tennis. And so then I saw an opportunity to go on the board of Tennis New Zealand, applied for that and got that. And then I was on there just for a little while, and then their high performance manager left, and they're like, oh, well, would you like to come in the office and work? And so I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds good. So then I did that. And so I was head of performance for tennis for over 5 years. And then, then you know, it's kind of like you stay in these jobs for around about 5 years, because then you've done your bit and you need, you know, new energy and lots of enthusiasm. Well, that's what I think anyway. And
yeah,
so then,
fresh ideas.
Yeah, yeah, because you can only do so much, and you've only got certain ideas yourself and energy for it. Because it's such a, well, I mean, I can speak to this some more, but in the NSO, you know, you've got such a diverse stakeholder group, and so many different people to deal with. And it's a membership organisation, and you're trying to satisfy the needs of the members, which are so complex that it's impossible. So you're always going to be getting people, you know, questioning you and asking you to do something different.
Lovely parents.
Yeah, and we're just, and clubs, and, you know, but it's because it's run predominantly by volunteers. So people are giving up their time for free, and you know, it's a complicated environment. Anyway, I left there, and then I was at, and then I ended up getting the job as CEO of Snow Sports New Zealand. And at the same time, I had been doing a, because I started on the board of Tennis New Zealand, that was the time where they were pushing for women to go on boards. And so I was in a Sport New Zealand program, which was great. And I ended up also going on the board of Canoe Racing New Zealand after that, just to keep that governance side of things going. And then I was the CEO of Snow Sports, which was great. And Snow Sports was fantastic. And they, you know, like, they are a great organisation. I really...
Leaps and bounds in the last decade.
Medals. Ordinary. You know, there's an indicator of the programs that they've got in right from the early age through to now. I mean, it's a good indicator.
Definitely. So I was there for 3 years. And it was great. It was a really enjoyable experience because they were so successful, and it culminated in them winning medals, you know, in the end. And then, but I was up and down because they're based in Wanaka. So I was up and down. And then in the end, I was like, okay, I kind of wanted to come back to Auckland. And so I left there. And the lady that had interviewed me for the snow sports job said, oh, there's a job at water polo. And in that little window between, I did the commentary for the America's Cup.
For TVNZ for quite a while. Did you do a few?
On and off, yeah. But at that moment in 2020, I was doing that. And then this water polo job came out. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I applied for that and got it. And so then I've been there. This is my fourth year there now. And then I was canoe racing board for 6 years. But I just finished just this April. And that was great too.
You probably gathered by now that we're kind of bouncing around all over the show like an out-of-control ping pong in a cube. We were talking about your children.
Yes.
And we never got any further. And I can see Rubber going, oh, so you stop stealing my thunder.
No, because we'll go back to that, to where Jan is now with water polo. But back with your kids and sailing and where they got to.
Oh, right. Okay, yes, that deviated somewhat.
Yeah, it did. That's
the nature of it. Yeah.
And shh, Joey, you talk too much.
I know. What do you do with them? You need to muzzle.
Fire you from the Chiefs.
Yes.
We're in Spain, came back, and Matthew basically made a conscious decision because he sailed the 420 and then, you know, also the 470 because, you know, that was sort of the Olympic classes back then for double-handed, let's say. And he made a conscious decision. He loved studying, loved university, all the academia, that, you know, the venture capital with your time, the risk reward, Olympic medal, it's not what where I want to put my energy. And so he really gave it away at age about 19, 20. Still, you know, loves the winging even today. He's got winging gear.
Hey, another winging.
There we go again. One episode. Can we get through one episode without the winging?
Yeah. So he's currently living in San Fran, and yeah, he's into that now. So that's all good, and loves, you know, all the other sports too, like that our family, you know, like to do. So just a diverse range. Gemma, on the other hand, she really liked the sailing, and I think, you know, it's also that a door opens and an opportunity opens, and I think that's what I would say almost happened with me. That presented itself that for the first time, women were able to go to the Olympics in sailing in 88, and so then you're like, okay, that's an opportunity, that's a door open. You're already preparing yourself for some luck to come along, and that's what happened. And so for her, she did the youths in the catamaran, and then twice, and then stepped into the NACRA from there. And she was only quite just straight out of youths into the NACRA, and sailed with Jason Saunders. And in their first worlds, it was a new class, and in their first worlds, they came ninth, and so they were immediately able to get funding from Yachting New Zealand because they were in that top 10 bracket. And so that, you know, kind of launched them. And then they went to the Olympics in 2016 and came fourth. And then, you know, which was, she loved it. And so she carried on with that. And then I think COVID came in 2020 and it was all really messy and it got really, yeah, blah, blah. And so she stopped, but she has continued to do other sailing. She did the Volvo 65 sprint around the world. They won that with Daryl Whistling. And then and is currently doing the Women's America's Cup. Amazing. Which is a great opportunity.
Incredible. Yeah. Like, doors open for her. She's just been in the right, Johnny in the spot, yeah, at the right time.
But at the same time, she's done 3 years of working at EY as a business consultant, because she, in 2020, she's like, okay, I'm back to university full time, finishing my degree during COVID, and did that, got a job, and so now, you know, has a career. And so that takes away all that wellness thing, because it's not like you're, I keep saying wellness, but it's well-being and you know, who am I, and you know, all that. Are you defined solely by your sport? I mean, it's fine if you've won like Barbara, like multiple medals, and you can be that, but not everybody does that. So you kind of need something more than that in your life.
Well, there's an end, isn't there, in a sporting career, and you've got to go beyond that. I see a lot of athletes in a number of sports that get to the end and they're lost. They don't know what to do.
Well, and additionally, because there's no financial pathway for them to sustain their life. Like if you're in a professional sport, completely different. Like golf, tennis, and all those sports, it's completely different. There's somewhere for everyone. In these small, more fringe sports that are funded by the government, you know, there's only a handful that are going to have the opportunity, and it's really tough.
Well, look how lost this bloke is.
He's in a professional.
I know. Still lost.
Don't know about that.
How's she enjoying the America's Cup boats?
Oh, she said they're really fun.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, to sail those now, you have to be young because it's so different. There's no going to the gym and you know, hiking out, and it's all buttons gaming.
But with her yachting history, she'd be very good at sailing at high speed and reading wind, and she ticks a lot of the boxes.
Yeah, I think also, you know, you say high speed. I'd suspect Barbara would be okay.
Go just
not,
fine.
No, not everybody, you know, is chasing speed and everything. You know, but well, she is that person, you know, like whether it's skiing or biking or whatever, winging, they like the high speed. But not everyone likes that. No, not everyone wants to go that both speeds on the
water. I like going too fast, like certain speed, and then like,
yeah,
you know, because it hurts when you fall off.
Yeah.
And you become a little bit more mature in what will happen when it hurts.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, that's
old age.
I know that's, yeah.
But that's so predominant with the park and pipes. Snow sports, because they have to, that's why they're so young.
Yeah, 16, 17, yeah, winning medals, because they have no fear, and they don't know what it is.
Unless they've been injured.
Until they've hurt themselves. And then does it change?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Once they get older and they've injured themselves, then it's kind of all over. But
it's game over. It reminds me of your brother.
Yes. Yeah. Just imagine if he'd been born in today's world. Holy moly.
Man, what a crazy man.
Yes.
What does the future look like for you, Jan Shearer?
Oh, retirement maybe. But
you're not going to retire. We've just gone through everything done. I don't think you'd seize up and keel over, wouldn't you? You want to keep doing things. How big's your engagement when it comes to the sailing world? Anything you'd like to see there? Any engagement you'd like to add?
That's a tricky one. I'm kind of removed from it. I mean, look, purposefully, because of my own involvement and then particularly Gemma. And, of course, Murray's involved hugely as well, not at an NSO level or in the Olympic classes anymore. But it's much, much easier for me to just go for other sports, work in and be engaged in other sports. Because
not emotionally attached either.
Exactly. And because we have that all the time. And the sports that I've worked in, you know, that emotional attachment, and then you've got agenda, you've got history, and it kicks in, and you can't be objective. And it's actually, I think, really, really beneficial to have neutral people working in these sports.
And just because Jan's not going to talk about this, but she's the CEO of New Zealand Water Polo, and Polly Powery, who won a gold and a silver, she's the manager of water polo, and I've sort of been hauled in by Jan to do some high-performance coaching as well. So you've got three female Olympic medal sailors working for water polo, and the cool thing is they placed ninth in the last World Championships, the women's team, coming from nowhere pretty much in 4 years, ninth in the world, two goals away from qualifying for Paris, definite pathway now for Los Angeles and definite pathway for Brisbane. So it's a really exciting time. And the only reason I came in, because Jan was there, because you know that she's an amazing operator.
I did see that when I was looking you up, when I was stalking you about powering. I thought that's really interesting. So tell us about the depth, these horrible puns, in water polo. How are we looking here in New Zealand? Plainly on the up and up. What has to happen?
So, well, they need money. What happened was we when I started, there was, a window opened because there was aspirational funding at High Performance Sport. And also, they also had a women's residency scholarship. So we went for both of those. And so the women's residency scholarship shuns Polly as our high performance manager. So that was an open and transparent application process in conjunction with High Performance Sport, and she was the standout applicant. So yeah, so she got that job. So they fund her for us in water polo, and sitting alongside that, the aspirational funding, High Performance Sport gave us $105,000 a year, which is not very much, but it helped. But not only, it's not so much the dollar value, it's that suddenly High Performance Sport are interested and engaged and partnering in the sport. And that sort of lifted the girls. It was a campaign funding just for the woman, because they had a little bit of a pathway and they had a bit of a program going. So we've elevated that. And now we're in another round of funding right now, because it's post-Paris. For the next 4 years. So we're just actually preparing our application for High Performance Sport now. And we part of that will be, we've done as much as we can with $100,000. We've done a lot and made it go a long way. So next round we need some more. It's so expensive, large team sports, honestly. Because all those other sports that I've worked in are small team or individual, and yachting too. It's expensive as well.
You're sending 15 girls away.
Yeah.
And then you've got five support staff. So when we went to the World Champs, there were 15 girls and five support to run the program. And we were away for 3.5-4 weeks, because we had a camp beforehand. And the problem is, too, you're not getting competition all the time either. So it's just like sailing. Mm. You're not getting that hardcore, fast competition against European teams. And so most of the water polo girls are based off overseas, playing in professional teams in Europe.
Let's just change, get off the girls.
Yeah, yeah.
Matthew. Matthew with his free diving. Like, that is, when I hear the stories from Murray about what your boy's up to, I find that terrifying.
As a parent, do you get worried?
You should. Oh, my God, you're not being taught. They go out, dive down with a spear gun, shoot a huge kingfish, and then fight the sharks to the surface. These stories are. He comes up, he shoots a big kingfish, and by the time he gets to the surface,
he's got much left.
It's a small kingfish.
Right. It's been such a sashimi.
The stories of that boy are just horrific.
Well, I suppose it all.
Maybe mothers don't hear these stories.
It looks like you didn't know.
I know. But I guess you could bring that back to, you know, the sailing, familiarity, you know, anything to do with the water. Like, yeah.
It takes, like, walking towards the fear, you know, looking fear in the eye.
Charging towards the bull.
You know what I mean? All those things we instill into the kids.
Right.
But that's gone too far. That's just bad parenting.
I don't want charming.
Like all of our podcasts, we could probably talk to you for the next couple of hours, but we just simply haven't got enough time. And time is money. We had neither of those. But Jan Shearer, thanks so much for coming up and sharing some stories with us. Just before you go, is there one message you'd like to send out there to the sailing community, the young'uns, to the old'uns, the middle-aged people? What would you say about the sport of sailing here in New Zealand or the hobby of sailing here in New Zealand?
Well, I think it's definitely a sport for life, and people love it, and we have access to it. And honestly, just about anybody you talk to has some connection to a boat or whatever. But just, I'm just going to say one more thing, because you're saying about, you know, the three medalists in water polo. But when I was, I was the chair of canoe racing, and the CEO was Tom Ashley. So there you go. And Polly worked there as well. So there's Polly, Tom, and me. And we're in canoe racing.
And how successful is canoe racing right now?
Oh, just quietly.
Yeah. So, there's some gold in this woman sitting in this room that needs to be tapped into.
It was just the connection thing that I thought I must just say that. But, oh, yeah, well, let's just... Lisa Carrington, phenomenal.
He tangata, the people. Yeah. It connects back to everything. Thank you so much for joining us. Really, really enjoyed our time. Maybe we do it again.
No problem.
We've got a few more tales, I'm sure. On behalf of Barbara Kendall, of Joey Big Mouth Allen, and Darcy Waldegrave, saying a thank you to Andu Feel Good. Thank you to the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron for allowing us up here as well in the Crow's Nest. This is Bird's Eye View, Live, Sail, Die podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed making it. You look after yourself.